Welcome to another episode of the Rain Race Podcast. Today we have another big weekend of World Endurance Championship and WeatherTech Sports Car Championship action to review. We'll be giving our thoughts on the 6 hours of Spa and the Motul Course de Monterey. At the end of the episode, we'll be discussing the latest news and rumors from both championships and answering some of your questions. If you enjoy this episode and you want to join us in the live discussion for the future, you can check out my YouTube channel, youtube.com/@GTRain. Again, youtube.com/@GTRain. Until next time, enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of the Rain Race Podcast, live, uninterrupted, no red flags here. I'm your host, GT Rain, joined alongside me, off to the right, it's off in the S's. How are you doing on this warm, for me at least, windows open May Tuesday evening?
It's lovely and warm up here too. You know, there's no complaints, the weather's heating up, there's more racing that's going on track, and we have red flags that are making... A six-hour race is almost 8 hours, so what could go wrong?
Or what? Hey, you know, is it bonus sports car racing, or is it, you know, what we're going like to talk about that all later on here.
It's like the equivalent of overtime, right?
That's what I said, right when we got the thing. I said, that's the overtime by Credit One Bank. You know, a lot of people will associate the month of May with two races of the Triple Crown in the Indianapolis 500 Monaco Grand Prix, but we do have a couple of sports car races that we're blessed with this month as well. This weekend, we had two of them. Again, this is the second episode in a row where we're going over an IMSA WEC doubleheader. So, a lot to cover from this weekend. We sort of gave a teaser to 6 hours of Spa. We're going to be covering the IMSA race at Laguna Seca. Got a little bit of news to cover at the end of the episode as well, so stick around for that. Obviously, I've mentioned before, mentioned it again, it's a live podcast, so if you have any questions you want to ask us, you have a nice chat box where you can tell us we're wrong, you can ask some questions, you can do whatever you so please, as long as it's within reason, and we'll try to get to as many of those throughout the episode as we can. Want to start things off here talking about the 6 hours of Spa. 6 hours, 7 hours, 45 minutes, whatever you want to call it, the WEC race at Spa this past weekend. A lot of takeaways from that race, both on track and off track. I'd say the first big thing to take away is that it was a record attendance for the World Endurance Championship outside of the 24 Hours of Le Mans. 3-day attendance of 88,180 people, which I heard, but I guess haven't officially confirmed, was the largest attendance outside of Le Mans. Massive crowd there. Massive crowd also even on Friday for the qualifying session, Free Practice 3 as well. Saturday race this year, it was a 3-day weekend going from Thursday, Friday, Saturday, rather than the, I guess, traditional weekend that we'd see of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Didn't have to go too far into the weekend, though, to get a bit of drama. We had a big crash in Hyperpole for the LMGT3 class with Alex Malikin. Big crash at the exit of Radeon in the Porsche, the Manti Racing Porsche. He was actually still able to start in eighth place, though. They, you know, you want to talk about the advantages of a GT3 category. I think a lot of people at the beginning of the season were saying, what are the big differences between GTE and GT3? I'll tell you one of them right now. There are a lot more GT3 cars out in the wild than there are GTE chassis. What they were actually able to do was rush over the Grello Manti Racing Porsche that we all associate with either the Nürburgring 24 Hours or the NLS as it is run over in that endurance championship that's run over in the Nürburgring as well. They were able to rush that chassis over to Spa, strip the bodywork off of it, put all the championship appropriate livery on it, and start the race. Actually, still start in eighth place. They didn't get forced to the back of the grid for making that change to the backup car. Also in the LMGT3 class, Hyperpole qualifying session, though, it was a best qualifying performance of the season that wasn't really to be for the number 95 United Autosports McLaren, which initially qualified on the front row P2, but they were disqualified after failing to meet the minimum weight requirement set for that car. Not the only time we're going to be talking about that here. Moving on to the Hyperpole qualifying session, I guess a nice segue there. One of the things I noticed, and I don't know if this was particularly for Spa, but I definitely noticed it here, was the tire fall off in qualifying. Again, I don't know if that's a high-speed Spa-specific thing. The cars are running a lot less downforce at Spa than they would be at the last two races we had at Qatar Imola. But it seemed like there was a very tight operating window in qualifying for those hypercars. They were running on the soft tire in the Hyperpole qualifying session, and it seemed like they really had, I'd say, probably two good laps to get a great time in. Towards the end of the session, we saw people darting back to the pits. Didn't really seem like they were going to be able to improve. Had a big moment for Kamui Kobayashi in the number 7 Toyota, where he looked like he might be on for a personal best time, and then got really squirrely in the third. I don't know if it's technically a third, or still the second sector of the track, and I'm not going to bother with Spa corner numbers either. But towards the latter half of the lap, had a big moment in qualifying as well. And then I guess one of the stories from the weekend, one of the main stories that that kicked off what we were talking about at Spa, was the pole time in the hypercar category. It's another pole position for Antonio Fuoco in the number 50A, of course, a Ferrari 499P. He's making a name for himself, a bit of a name as a qualifying strong driver. He had that initial Ferrari debut pole at Sebring last year, leaving his mark there. Got the debut at Le Mans last year. Got the pole position at Imola. Now the pole position at Spa. So we thought, at least, because that time as well was also disallowed due to the exact same reason as the number 95 McLaren for being under the weight specification by 1 kilogram. And it was actually noted that that 1 kilogram difference was a mistake. It was due to, at least this is Ferrari's claim, that it was due to an issue that they had with changing some rear bodywork on the car after contact in free practice 3. Whatever new rear bodywork they put on the car was not to the exact same specification as what they were previously running. Quite a few stories there, Stu, from qualifying alone. And we haven't even talked about the 6, 7 hour, 45 minute race yet.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the couple of things that stood out to me were, of course, the accident that we saw at Radeon with the Porsche, and just how they were able to turn it all around, turn the car around, a new car, get it ready for the race the following day. Pretty incredible work there. You gotta tip your cap whenever you see an effort like that. And then also just the safety improvements that we've seen there in recent years at that series of corners at Spa. You know, this was not a light lick for sure. And as that car appeared after the accident, but you gotta tip your cap again to the safety improvements that have been made at that corner. One of the things that stood out for me is in that post sort of qualifying interview, there was, Fuoco, right, that was on pole. Yeah. He had made a comment about, you know, finding something that the other Ferrari, that their sister Ferrari team maybe hadn't found. And I got a chuckle when the news came out that they were found to be underweight. But I mean, regardless of that, I think there was still, it wasn't a small margin between those two cars. No. But really what surprised me the most was Toyota and their qualifying efforts. Definitely not one that they want to remember. And, you know, I don't think we're going to expect to see, you know, both of, I don't think we're going to expect to see that perform that type of performance in qualifying from Toyota going forward. But that was a bit of a surprise to see both of them not make it through to, well, one of them made it through to Hyperpole, right. but one of them, of course, not making it through.
Well, and that's one of the stories of the season, I think, is Toyota's pace. Last year, apart from the 24 hours of Le Mans, they had the ultimate pace out of everybody in the field at every other race. You know, it was pretty close at some other tracks, like Sebring. Ferrari got the pole last year. Fuji last year, Porsche was able to hold off Toyota for probably about 4 hours of the race. But overall, Toyota had the dominant car last year. And I think a lot of people, myself included, were looking at the first couple of races this season. We were racing at Qatar and we were racing at Imola. Those are new tracks of the World Endurance Championship. nobody was going into those tracks with any data, any prior data that they could work off of. They had no setup knowledge going into those tracks. I thought going to Spa, maybe Toyota would regain a bit of that confidence there and some of that raw performance that we'd come to expect from them. But, you know, even at a track like Spa, where they've been uber competitive since 2018, didn't really seem like it was a weekend they want to remember.
Yeah, it was not. It certainly wasn't a weekend to remember in qualifying, and it didn't really get a whole lot better going into the race either.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in a second here. I do want to give a quick shout to the cars that actually qualified in the front row, on the front row, in Hyperpole after the disqualifications were made. It was another pole position, first one on the season though, for the Iron Dames number 83 Lamborghini. A fantastic qualifying effort from Sarah Bovey in that car. Also a fantastic first stint in that car as well. And then in second place, it was the number 46 Team WRT BMW. Hyperpole qualifying session, it was an LMDH 1-2 with the number 5 Penske Porsche picking up the 100th pole position for Porsche in sports car racing, and the number 2 Cadillac picking up P2 with their best qualifying result. Best qualifying result, I want to say, since Le Mans last year, but I might not be 100% correct with that. In fact, I think I am wrong. I think they qualified better at some of the later races like Monza. So moving on to the race, though, we were talking about Toyota's lack of pace in the race, lack of raw pace. One of the other things I noticed is that it just wasn't a flawless race from Toyota. Couple of mistakes that you typically wouldn't really see from them. They were really, I don't want to say they were a really seasoned racing team. I still think they are a really seasoned racing team. But more mistakes than I think a lot of people would have expected from them. There was a 5-second stop and hold penalty for the number 8 Toyota very early on in the race for a technical infringement. Later on in the race, the number 7 Toyota got a drive-through penalty for a VSC infringement. And then they too got a five second penalty, not a 5-second stop and hold, in the final stint of the race for contact with the Iron Dames Lamborghini in turn 1. So, you know, you got to look at the position they're in right now. They're not the raw pace setters that they were last year. They are having to fight more for those positions. And with that, I think we're starting to see a couple of these mistakes pop up here and there.
Yeah. A few more mistakes creeping up. And again, you know, it's easy to just concentrate on running a flawless race when you're not, when you're the clear class of the field and you don't have to worry about anybody really being in the same, you know, performance window as you. But at this point in time, Toyota is in the same performance window as a lot of the other hypercar entries that are out there with them. And, you know, you're going to succumb to some of that pressure sometimes and take, you know, these 5-second penalties, or as we were talking about just a moment ago, if you're going to push a little bit too hard and maybe make a mistake in your quality run and not make it through to Hyperpole. I wonder how much of this is, you know, just genuine mistakes, or if there is a component of, you know, Toyota's being pressured into making some of these mistakes a little bit more often than we would expect them to see.
Yep. And I do want to correct myself, since it was brought up in the chat that it was the 100th pole for Team Penske in sports car racing, not the 100th pole for Porsche. easy to make that mistake. Also want to talk about Cadillac in the first hour of the race. We're talking about how strong they were in qualifying. First hour of the race, they were starting on that qualifying tire set from the Hyperpole session, and it didn't really seem to favor them. They dropped from second place all the way back to 8th. Didn't seem to have the pace to battle that number 5 Porsche in the first stint of the race. They ended up getting passed by the 99 Proton Competition Porsche after a few laps, and then just continued falling down the order until they were able to make that first pit stop. I was a bit concerned seeing that pace initially and wondering if maybe they had the car really set up great for qualifying. Maybe it was a fantastic qualifying lap and they just don't have the raw race pace. But it seemed like that was really only an issue that was plaguing them in that initial stint. And in fact, there was an interview earlier on in the race where it was mentioned that they were specifically struggling on that tire set. I believe it was Alex Lynn. Could have been Earl Bamber as well. I can't remember who started that car. who said that they were struggling with that qualifying tire set. But the race did seem to come back to them for quite a while until it didn't. And we'll get back to that in a little bit later on. Toyota and Cadillac, though, they were not the only two hypercar manufacturers to have issues in the race. Actually, before the race even started in the Hyperpole session, the number 35 Alpine needed an engine replacement after they had an engine failure in that Hyperpole session. The number 50 Ferrari also reported some floor damage earlier on in the race. I can't imagine it was anything too significant because they seemed like they still had a good amount of pace, but maybe it was hindering them a little bit. One of the notables for me was the first suspension, not the first, the first issue, reliability issue for Lamborghini with their new SC63 LMDH car in the form of a suspension failure about halfway through the race. It's the first reliability strike against them. How many times have I mentioned now, when is Lamborghini going to run into reliability issues? Didn't come at Sebring, didn't come at Qatar, didn't come at Imola, but fourth race out at probably the most high-speed race there. Are going to do before Le Mans, and they run into an issue with the suspension. I guess better here than at Le Mans is all I could really say on that, but that 100% reliability record, unfortunately, out the window for them.
Couldn't last forever.
Yep. And then also Neil Jani in the 99 Proton Competition 963 struggling with the door on that car. About halfway through the race, finally able to close it under the safety car after what seems like a good 5 minutes of trying to get that issue settled. On the topic of Proton Competition, I want to talk about that team in a little bit more detail because I think Proton's performance at Spa was phenomenal, and I think it was very unexpected as well. They seemed so far since their debut last year to be second best to Jota in terms of the Porsche customer teams, but what a performance they had at Spa, and particularly what a drive from Julian Einlauer, who I think was probably my vote for driver of the race. I mean, he was making absolutely incredible passes up Radeon multiple times. I think it happened at least three or four times throughout the race that it was even caught on camera. Maybe it happened more than that. And I think at a lot of the race, it was Proton's race to lose. And they were ultimately one of those manufacturer or one of those teams that were caught out with that red flag situation later on in the race. But apart from that, I think Proton put up a better performance than Jota at that race. And I know it's a little bit odd to say that given the final outcome of that race, but you look at where they were for the first five, or I guess I'll say the first 4 hours of the race before the red flag. You know, I think that they really could have been a contender for that win had the race not had the red flag situation.
Yeah, I was thoroughly impressed by Proton as well. I felt like I kept looking, you know, looking at the screen and seeing this white with hints of red Porsche. And I just immediately assumed battling at the sharp end of the hypercar field, and I just immediately thought, oh, that's one of the Penske Porsches. But then, you know, you look a little bit closer and no, that's the Proton Porsche that was consistently up fighting at the front, passing, you know, the factory outfits. They looked seriously strong in this race, and I completely agree with you. I thought they were the most impressive privateer entry in this race, even though they didn't get that top result.
Yeah. Now, with all the hype around the hypercar class, no pun intended, by the way, I feel like LMGT3 gets overlooked quite a bit nowadays. And I'm not going to exclude myself from that. I'll definitely admit that I talk a lot more about the hypercar category than the LMGT3 class, but I will say, at the 6 hours of Spa, the LMGT3 class put on some great, great battles and a lot of great storylines out of that as well. We already talked about the Iron Dames effort and how strong they were, especially in the first stint of the race. We had some fantastic battles throughout the race for some of the new manufacturers as well to WEC GT Racing, notably McLaren and Lamborghini. But we also had some fantastic battles for the lead between the two Manti Porsches. The end of the race ended up coming down to a battle between those two cars. The 60 iron Lynx Lamborghini was thrown in there as well. LMGT3, I think there were a lot of questions from people at the start of the season as to, you know, what's really the point of this? It's a pro-am class. Why couldn't we have a fully pro GT lineup? I don't like this as much as GTE. But I think that this race in particular, I think, proved a lot of those doubters wrong, that LMGT3 really does have a place in the World Endurance Championship. Sure, I'll admit GT3 racing can be a bit saturated nowadays. There's plenty of GT3 racing on the market. In fact, if you want top-level GT racing nowadays, you're pretty much looking only at GT3. But I don't think that should take away from what we saw at the 6 Hours of Spa at all from that class.
Yeah, I will echo what you've said, that, you know, it was great to see so many different manufacturers battling towards the front end of the grid in this one over the course of the 6 hours. Yeah, and it came down right to the final lap, really, in that class as well. It was the last couple of laps, just an insane finish, and you'll get to that in a second.
Yeah. Wasn't smooth sailing, though, for everybody in the LMGT3 class. And one team I want to talk about in particular, where I guess some of the hometown favorites in Team WRT with their two-car BMW M4 GT3 program. Lost two cars in that race due to no fault of their own, really. They lost the 46 car after contact with the number 38 Jota Porsche 963, which the Jota had contact with the number 20 Team WRT BMW hypercar. So I guess it's WRT hurting Jota that then in turn hurts WRT GT3 car. But overall, took them out of the race. I think that they were a really early favorite for that race. They were my pick for the second race in a row, and I felt pretty confident about it until, unfortunately, they were taken out. And a big fan favorite with that car as well, being the car that Valentino Rossi is driving in. And then, of course, we're going to talk about the number one thing. I think the biggest story to come out of this race is the contact that we had, the massive accident that we had between the number 31 WRT BMW and the number 2 Cadillac hypercar, whilst the Cadillac was battling the Proton Competition 963 for third place. There's about an hour and 45 minutes left in the race. I'll tell you what, the Cadillac and the Proton were really battling nose to tail for quite a few laps at that point. There was a bit of, we'll use the Calvin Fish argy bargy going on there. Some blocking going on down the Kemmel Straight for a lot of the race between or from the 99 Proton Competition Porsche. And I think Earl Bamber just got a little bit overconfident. I think that's what we'll chalk it up to, is just a sheer case of overconfidence. Thought he was going to get away with trying to go past the 99 car when the door wasn't really there. What was there was the 31 WRT BMW, and the two of them came together at very high speed. Luckily, it wasn't a larger accident than it was. It could have definitely been worse with how much air the Cadillac ended up getting. But what it did give us in return was a red flag with an hour and 45 minutes left in the race. And I think this is where the race really took a turn. You know, a lot of people were wondering if that would spell the end of the race, myself included. We didn't know how long the barrier repairs were going to take. And I thought initially maybe it would be an hour repair, and then it looked like maybe an hour and a half. We might only get 15 minutes of racing. And then I started saying, I don't think this race is going to end at all. But then the WEC pulled a complete rule flip on us. Now, I'm a bit unprepared for this, admittedly, because I have the rules pulled up. I have screenshots of the rule book, and it's time for me to pull out the rule book, but they're over on my tablet, which is behind me. So what I'm going to do while I get that is, Stu, I want some of your thoughts on that contact that we saw between the BMW GT3 car and the Cadillac. I'm assuming you're probably in the same boat as I am with who was at fault for that, but not really what you want to see. And it's also the second year in a row that Cadillac has had a massive crash at Spa in the hands of that hypercar.
Yeah, it's been a rough go for Cadillac at Spa. Their record isn't so hot, but yeah, this was it was actually pretty funny. I when this incident came up, I was actually out in the morning, and I had just pulled up the stream to see how things were going at this point, and I witnessed this crash as it was happening. And you know, the first thoughts that run through your mind are, you know, this is one of the fastest points of portions of the track, the Kemmel straight, it's all out. And to see an accident like that at such high speed and a car, you know, spinning around in the air, it was pretty scary. Again, we kind of get to see another example of just, unfortunately, it's Cadillac that seems to be giving us a lot of the examples of just how safe these cars are right now. And just the beating that they can take and still keep the driver safe. But for Earl Bamber here, it was, you know, he saw an opportunity. You don't know when you're going to get a run on to be able to make an overtake like this. You know, there's always the argument that at this point there was like just under 2 hours to go left in the race. There's a ton of time left. You can be a little bit more patient. But when you're in that moment, it's a little bit more difficult to reel yourself in if you see that opening and you try and go for it. And you know, it was if a fraction of a second more, just a fraction of a second, if he waits that long to be able to make that pass, then you know we're maybe talking about one of the passes of the race, depending on what they go on, how the race ends. Goes on to finish, but instead, you know, it's not he it, clearly this is all on Earl Bamber here. I mean, they also picked up I think a penalty for Le Mans as a result of it, a grid penalty. You know, the BMW's right there, and kind of the rest is history. It was unfortunate to see because it took out a lot of good cars. Well, I guess the two good cars. But also lucky that nobody else got caught up in that. Both those cars went flying back across the track, and thankfully there was nobody else that got caught up in it. So an unfortunate accident to see, but you know, sometimes mistakes like that are made, and fortunately this is one of those moments.
Yeah. So the result of that, I already said, was a red flag. Now it's time for WEC rulebook time. Here we go. Article 14.4.5. Concerning all cars at the resumption of the race. Now, this is the wrong regulation. I'm sorry. That's not what I
Oh
wanted
no.
to have pull
I can talk a little bit about the decision to delay or to actually resume the race. I think I don't think anybody's going to argue and saying that this was the right decision to do, especially considering they had the ability to do it. I can't remember. I think it was a couple of years ago at Watkins Glen, in the 6 hours of the Glen, there was a red flag right towards the end of the race as well. And IMSA ultimately made the decision to stop the clock. And we were able to get like 45 minutes of racing in. And you know that we're fortunate to be able to do that because the TV window that IMSA was allotted or had with NBC, they were able to extend that a little bit, and thus they made the decision to sort of just put the race on pause. Thankfully, the WEC didn't have any, you know, I guess I don't know what their TV rights agreements are like, but they were able to make the decision, and maybe Chris, you'll be able to elaborate on this a little bit with what the rules say. But we were very much in the dark on whether this race was going to resume right down to the last moment, and was quite pleased to see that we were able to get this race resumed and have some more good racing towards the end of it. Did I stall long enough for you
You
to
stalled,
be
yeah. You
able to?
stalled plenty of time. I pulled up the
Perfect.
PDF on my computer now. I've given up. We're gonna pull up the PDF. I'm on page 46 of the regulations. So, looking at the WEC rulebook for the decision there, this is Article 14.3.1, suspension of a race under red flag procedure, which specifies that while the race is suspended, if the circumstances so require, the stewards may take the decision to stop and or modify the race time set. This may not exceed the time of the competition provided for in Appendix 1 of the competition, which, to my knowledge, that time specified was just basically the weekend. It couldn't go beyond Saturday. So as long as they finished it within that day, it was fine. So first things first, I want to talk about the legality of that move. We actually saw a protest from Ferrari after the race that was really tossed out very quickly, plain and simply because no rules were really broken here. And actually, I think, let's just say it as it is, this was a very controversial decision. You talk about how favorable and how much of a right decision it was for them to make, and I'll agree with you on that. I think from a fan perspective, this was absolutely the best decision they could have made, especially for the fans who suck around to the track and were patient while they had that almost 2-hour red flag period. I think the real controversy does not lie with that, though. I think the controversy lies with the fact that under the red flag condition, and then also after the subsequent safety car period before they went back green, the cars that had not pit before the red flag were not able to take on additional fuel, except for an emergency fuel stop, which really only gave them a couple laps worth of fuel. So breaking that down, if we go back a little bit further, right before that incident between the Cadillac and the BMW, the number 12 Jota, number 6 Penske Porsche, and number 36 Alpine all pit for a scheduled pit stop. They all filled up to max fuel and max energy. Now, on the grid for the red flag, everybody was allowed to change tires. There was a ton of debris that went around as a result of that accident. So they wanted to give everybody a fair chance to change tires, make sure that they wouldn't restart with a puncture or anything like that. They did not have the ability to add fuel, though. And this is where I start to question. I'll say this many times. You can have a right decision being made, but still have room for improvement. And I think this is a quintessential case of one of those examples where I think I like the idea that they are able to extend the race more than the advertised distance, but I do think there should be some modification on whether cars are actually allowed to add fuel. Because if we look, I'm going to do this again. If we look at the rule for safety car procedure, the cars are allowed to enter the pit lane. This is way too long. This thing, I'm putting it away. I'm tossing it away because I can't read through that entire rule book right now, but they are allowed to pit under the safety car procedure for fuel. So my question is, why are they not allowed to do that after red flag? I think that really sets aside that tossed aside all of these other teams that would have had a chance at the race win from being in contention to do that. It tossed away any chance that Ferrari had. Mm-hmm. It tossed away any chance that Toyota had. And that's just the hypercar category. We're not even talking about LMGT3. There's no real harm in doing that to me, because I think you're still going to have the cars that pit before the red flag came out. They're still going to have an advantage because they're still going to cycle to the lead when everybody else pits for fuel. So I can't understand that aspect of it too much. I kind of hope that's something that they evaluate changing before the end of the season. I think this was, let's just say it as it is, this was a very rare case here where it was like a perfect storm of things to mess up the race for a lot of people. It was a red flag at the perfect time for a few manufacturers, a few teams, and the worst time for an equal number of teams. Actually, more teams got hurt than it than benefited. So that's something I would change personally. I think that gives them the opportunity in the future to go through the exact same procedure and then just have more people be fond of that decision to extend the race. Because right now it's been a bit split 50-50 from what I've seen in terms of the fan reception from it. And I can say there are a lot of unhappy, not just fans from that decision, but also teams that seemed like they weren't too pleased with the decision to extend the race. Not going to call it any names, but if you know who got the wrong end of the stick from that, it shouldn't be all too surprising. So after the restart, with an hour and 45-ish minutes to go, The hypercar class still had some great battles on the restart, but I will say it felt like the race for the win was reduced, really, to the number 12 Jota Porsche and the number 6 Porsche Penske Porsche, the factory car. And I think that sort of took the wind out of the sails a little bit. I mean, we have a great restart here. Nobody was expecting the race was going to get going, and then all of a sudden we're told we have almost 2 hours of, I guess, bonus overtime, and it really comes down to a battle between two different cars. Still had Julian Andlauer in the 99 Proton Porsche ripping passes through the field through Eau Rouge, but in terms of the race lead, it was actually Callum Ilott and the number 12 Jota that was pulling away from the number 6 Porsche for the final couple of stints. And in the LMGT3 class, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but it really turned into an energy conservation race in the final stint. The Iron Lynx number 60, the LMGT3 leader, in the final 10 minutes, or I guess the entire final stint, we'll say, had to pit with one lap left in the race. Was it one or two laps left in the race? I can't remember exactly.
It was the final lap.
Final lap.
Yeah, so it was one to go. Yeah.
Yeah. They had to pit with one to go due to not having enough energy to finish the race. And I guess the question from a lot of people is, how did they not have enough time to save that one lap of energy? I mean, they had an entire stint at the end of the race. It wasn't like they were in a side-by-side battle for the lead. They definitely would have had a little bit of room to let up. So to my knowledge, that sort of seems like it was a miscalculation on their part. And once they realized that they weren't going to be able to make it to the end, then they went to a full push strategy to try to make up any additional time that they were going to lose from that final splash and go. But I'd say it's a miscalculation from them. I think they had the pace to win. I think they had the right strategy to win, but they just needed to save a little bit of energy or a little bit of fuel in that final stint. What it came down to, though, after they had to pit, was a last lap battle for the LMGT3 class win between the two Manti Racing Porsches. And actually, on the final lap, it was the number 92 car, the one that crashed in the Hyperpole qualifying session, that had to, I guess, sort of say, give up the win to the number 91 car. They really didn't put on a tough fight. They were saving a lot more energy on that final lap than the 91 and didn't really put up much of a fight at all at the end of the Kemmel straight. So tough to see it all come down to a fuel conservation race or an energy conservation race like that. But overall, I think the LMGT3 class, as I said earlier, still provided a fantastic amount of action from that race. And going into Le Mans, we're going to have an increase of entries for that race. I'm only expecting even more there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think LMGT3, you mentioned earlier, it's proved its worth on the grid. It's shown us some great racing throughout the season, and we got a little bit of a different taste in this one, a fuel strategy race right down to the very end. You know, it sucks when a car, when a team that you're cheering for has to pit with, you know, one lap to go, or is still has to conserve fuel in order to make it to the finish, and they end up losing the win. But it certainly made for a dramatic final couple of minutes there, and it was entertaining to watch. That's for sure.
Yep. So in the hypercar class, I almost said hyperpole. In the hypercar class, it was a first win for Hertz Team Jota with the number 12. That's the new car that they started running this year, that Porsche 963, over the factory number 6 Porsche Penske Motorsport 963. And then in third place, it was the number 50 AF Corsa Ferrari. Rounding out at the podium, what I really think they would have wanted to come home with a win there. I mean, that's the second race in a row where Ferrari had the ultimate pace to win. At Imola, it was their mistake. At Spa, it was nothing really they could have done different. It was just circumstance that they ended up falling into. You know, I want to talk about the winners and losers of this race. And apart from Jota and Manti, of course, winning in class, one of the other winners, I would say, would be Alpine. They had some engine trouble in qualifying, of course, but I think they showed promising race pace, as I predicted they would. And this is the second highest speed circuit. Well, I don't know if this is the second highest speed circuit or Fuji technically is, going into Le Mans. So to have the pace that they had here wasn't ultimately race leading pace, but I still think it's pretty promising to have that pace going into the 24 hours of Le Mans. And then on the losing side of things, Cadillac. I mean, what more can you say? This was a chance for them to get their best race result, their first top five since Le Mans last year, and ultimately came down to an over-aggressive move. I mean, we can talk about it for 3 hours if we want on how, you know, if they waited just a half a second longer, they could have been on the podium for that race. But ultimately, that's going to be one that they want to forget, and hopefully a lesson that they can take to Le Mans.
I it came to my mind that I would almost put Cadillac as a winner in this, just because this is really the first race this year that they've actually looked like they were in contention, like serious contention. Right. I know that they obviously, yes, that accident definitely kicks them down. That could make you a loser in for sure. But it was a win for them in the sense that, you know, they were very competitive this weekend. And that's going to be something for them to at least take away, along with a bunch of broken pieces heading into Le Mans.
Yep. And in the LMGT3 class. Oh, actually, before we talk about that. Also, the other thing for Cadillac, picking up a 5-place grid penalty for the 24 hours of Le Mans as a result of that incident. I mean, not a good start to the month of June, really. You're going into Le Mans, haven't even shipped the car over there yet, and you're starting 5 places lower than you probably want to. So it's not really a big penalty for them. It's not something they're going to have to worry about in the race, but takes away any chance they had of getting a pole at Le Mans and any chance they had at even starting in the top 5 at Le Mans, which is not going to be too great for that those starting pictures.
Yep.
In the LMGT3 class, big winners of the day were the two Manti Racing Porsches. This was a 1-2 result from them. Porsche had a very strong weekend in sports car racing, I'll say that much. So it's the number 91 Manti EMA car over the number 92 Manti Pure Racing 911. And then the number 60 Iron Lynx Lamborghini rounding out the top three. I think Lamborghini can walk out of that weekend with their heads held high. They were one of the manufacturers that I think had a little bit more potential overall. Didn't quite have things go their way on that red flag restart, but ultimately a lot more performance from those two than we've seen earlier on this season. Same thing I'll say about McLaren as well. The number 59 United Autosports McLaren showing great pace in that race, leading quite a bit of it as well. And then the Ford Mustangs as well, the number 88 and number 77 Proton Mustangs, both of them finishing in the points at Spa and starting to turn the program around for that new Ford Mustang GT3.
And neither of them lost the trunks or the...
That's true.
Was it the boot lid?
It's the boot, because the bonnet is the hood. Yes, there you go. I'm starting to pick up on it. finally... I want to talk about the losers from the LMGT3 category, which I only really have one, is Team WRT. I mean, this was a race they were one of the favorites to win, and I mentioned this earlier. Either of those cars probably could have won the race, especially the number 46 car, but taken out by two accidents that were neither of their own, and just a really tough weekend for them, especially being the points leaders going into the weekend at Spa. Now they're going to be rebounding to Le Mans without that advantage that they had. So I want to talk briefly about the points in both championships. The top three in the hypercar category are the number 6 Porsche Penske Motorsport 963. A really, really consistent season so far from that team. Worst finish out of the top first three races of the season is second place. And then in second place, talking about second, is the Hertz Team Jota, number 12 winners from Spa. No points at the previous race in Imola, but were able to pick up max points. Not max points, because they didn't get pole, but pick up 25 points from Spa. And then it's the number 7 Toyota. You know, the car that won Imola didn't really have a great race here at Spa, but still showing a good amount of consistency throughout the season. I think they're maximizing the pace that they really have with that car right now. And if they're able to find some more raw performance out of that car in the latter half of the season, they're still definitely in the points hunt as well. But a big lead right now for the number six Porsche. And then over to the LMGT3 category is also a Porsche leading the points table over there with an equally dominant lead over second place, the number 92 Manti Pure Racing 911 over the number 31 WRT BMW that unfortunately walked out of spot with 0 points. And then in third place, it is the 27 Heart of Racing Aston Martin tied for second place right now, also with 37 points. So, a couple things I want to read from the chat going over the race at Spa. I saw somebody mention they can't fuel the cars in the grid since the fuel rigs are in the pits, and they can't enter the pits since the entry was closed. Yeah, so that's the part. I don't have a problem with that. I do wonder, though, about the safety car period after the red flag. I think that they should have the opportunity to go in there and take a full fuel service during that red or during that safety car period. But yeah, during the red flag when they're all lined up on the grid, there's nothing they really could have done about that. Didn't the Ferrari on paper get some bad BOP? Foco storming from almost the way back was crazy. They did have a weight increase and I believe a slight power decrease from Imola as well. You know, you can't really look at BOP as this car got an increase of weight, therefore they have a bad balance of performance. The thing you have to realize is that in theory, the balance of performance is based off thousands of simulation runs that the ACO and the FIA are doing to try to set that balance of performance for each car. So really, it's not supposed to be performance dependent. You're not supposed to see a system where if Ferrari wins at Imola, which they didn't, but if they did, they get tanked the next race or vice versa. It's really supposed to be fully independent of that. Whether or not that's actually the case, I guess, is the great mystery. But I think they had the ultimate pace to win Spa, definitely. I think they were the favorite to win going in, looking at what we saw from them in practice and looking at what we saw in qualifying before they were disqualified. And then also their pace in the earlier stages of the race. I think they could have won that race. And they would have won that race, actually, had it not resumed from the red flag. But, you know, one that got away from them again, I suppose.
They were certainly our picks to win.
Oh, yeah. let's see. I want to see. So a couple people were talking about Cadillac earlier. This one from Troy McGarity. Cadillac does not have the data of the WC tracks that Porsche and Ferrari have from years of GT racing. Also, way more cars entered. Cadillac has tons of experience with the IMSA tracks. So I don't know how much that data translates from from GT over to hypercar. Obviously the setups are going to be pretty substantially different. I saw somebody did respond to that saying, well, GM would also have Corvette data that they could pool into to try to help out Cadillac. But ultimately, I think the big thing that hurts Cadillac in the World Endurance Championship is they only have one car.
Yeah.
If you look at Porsche, they have 5 cars right now. You look at Ferrari and they have 3. So the proof is in the numbers, I would say, yeah. Where you have one car that you're gathering data from, and these other manufacturers, while they might not be working fully together. I mean, I'm sure that Jota is not sharing data with the factory team and with Proton, but you still have that. You have more bullets in the chamber, is I guess all I'll say.
Well, you have more data coming in too.
Well, sure. For the manufacturer, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Julian Anlauer, people have given him high praise. Beast through Eau Rouge. Eau Rouge, a.k.a. the Anlauer curve. The Mustangs have been disappointing here, showing my age, but I saw all most of the drivers race in the M3 GT2 back in the ALMS days. Some of them may not be as quick as they used to be. You know, I think I talked about Mustang. I think that they had a pretty decent performance here. What we got to remember is this is a brand new car. A lot of these GT3 cars, particularly the Lexus, has been around for a long time. And although Acodus ASP has not run the Lexus for as long as it's been around, this is their first year running it, that car has a lot more maturity in it. So, you know, you can talk about the pros and cons of having a new car. Pros would be it's probably going to perform better if it was completely unrestricted. Cons are it's a brand new car that you don't really have any reliability data to work off of. You still have to sort of build that car up. So I think we're going to see more promising performance out of that Mustang in the future, especially on the WEC side of things. So I would say stay tuned for that later on in the season is when I'd expect them to start picking up some better performances. But showing the pace that they had at Spa being a high speed track, I don't know, maybe they're a bit of a dark horse pick for Le Mans. That would certainly be a big story.
A dark horse pick, like the Ford Mustang dark horse?
Oh, I wasn't even trying that, you know. I wasn't even trying, but we'll take it. Couple people talking about the decision to resume the race. Eduardo Freitas made a right decision to resume the race. A decision, I'll say, I don't think was in many people's mindset at all. The commentary team certainly wasn't talking about the possibility of it. And I talked about how much of a win it was for the fans. The one loss, I'll say, the fans took from all of that is that some of the people left the track early because they didn't realize the race was going to resume. They didn't realize the race had the ability to resume. They were trying to beat the traffic up because I think Spa's like a one country road leading up to it, much like Sebring, by the way. And they were trying to take advantage of that. So very unexpected, but yeah, I think overall it was the right decision, a controversial one at that. But as I said earlier, I think the controversy comes more down to the fueling issue than the resumption of the race itself. I'll come back to some more of these later on. I do want to turn the tables over and hop across the world as Roger Penske did, going from Spa over to the IMSA WeatherTech sports car race at Laguna Seca, because we're talking about unexpected winners in the World Endurance Championship race. I think we also have a couple of unexpected winners to report on from Laguna Seca as well.
Yeah, maybe some unexpected winners and the car that we just expect to lose every race at this point as well. I don't know if 31's ever going to get a win. But to just quickly touch on the qualifying session before we hop into the race, it was the 0-1 of Sebastian Bourdais laying down a very nice lap time to beat Pipo Durrani and end his reign of poles. Bourdais put in a lap time, a tenth of a second faster than Durrani. And honestly, not surprising based on the pace that they were showing in qualifying. But Philippe Eng in the BMW M Team RLL number 24 qualifying in third. The BMWs showed great pace all weekend. And you know what? Throughout the weekend, and especially in qualifying, all four of the manufacturers had cars that were within throwing distance of pole. There was nobody that was tremendously off the pace. It was good to see there. Now, as we flip over to the race, things will change a little bit. But the Cadillacs locking out the front row here at Laguna Seca. It was actually an all GM front row as we go down into the GTD Pro class as well. GM had a pretty good qualifying day here as the two Corvettes breaking through with some strong performances here. They were pretty significantly faster than the other manufacturers in qualifying. And that good pace would transition over to the race. They beat the next closest competitor, was the Pfaff McLaren showing some pace. They were half second off though. And then in GTD, you know, we talk about a car that we haven't seen towards the front of the grid much this season, or even really, I guess specifically this season, and the 45 Wayne Taylor Racing with Andretti Lamborghini. Danny Formel, put that car on pole in that class. So it was great to see them, get a nice quick result in qualifying. Flipping things over to the race though, it was kind of a little bit night and day from some of the other races that we've seen so far this season. It was a nice clean start in both of these, in all three of the classes, but both of the split starts, it was clean on both ends of it. The pole sitters in all of the classes were able to hold the lead for the early portion of that race. And one of the things that we saw in this race that we haven't seen, well, I guess one of the things we didn't see in this race that we've seen a ton of in the earlier races this season was the lack of safety cars. There was one full course yellow throughout this entire race, and it was not for really an accident. It was for debris that ultimately came off the number seven Porsche Penske 963, brought out the full course yellow and initiated, you know, a round of pit stops. One of the weird things that happened on this round of pit stops, and I want to ask if you heard anything about this at all. When they were coming off of pit road, it was very obvious that the 31 Cadillac beat the number six Porsche off of pit road. But then we saw a similar moment to what we saw at Indianapolis last year. There Yep. was some side-by-side running behind the safety car. And, you know, we never really got a great explanation as to why the six was the car leading us to green. I heard in the broadcast there was mention of something about a scoring loop or where the actual end of pit road was. But I never saw a good clear explanation as to why the six was the one that led us to the green flag. Did you hear anything about that?
So on the NBC broadcast, it was mentioned that it was the exact same thing actually that happened at Indy last year, which was actually, was it between those same two cars at Indy last year?
It was one of the Porsches and the 31 for sure.
I can't remember if it was the six or the seven.
Yeah.
That's what I had heard. And that's what I've been running with since then, that once IMSA triggered the, I guess we'll say the wave around, because the 31 car didn't go right away, the six went past them and IMSA said, well, stop sleeping and let the Porsche hold on to the race lead for the restart. I didn't know if that was a rule that they had changed after Indianapolis or not, but evidently, if this is the same case that happened at Laguna Seca, I guess not.
Yeah, it would seem so. That makes sense, though, and that's kind of what I was thinking. But we never heard anything. We were just going back to green, and the six was leading us. So, Okay, so that makes sense then. If that was the case, regardless, though, the battle would not last long between the 31 and the six here. The 31 made quick work. It got around the six and would resume the race lead for much of the latter half of this race. You know, the 31 and the Cadillacs in general, the 01 led the opening stint of this race and looked very strong doing so. And then when the driver changes happened and Sebastian Bourdais came out of the car and Ranger got into the car, Ranger just didn't quite look as strong as Seb did. But the real battle here was between the 31 and the six as the race went on. On the final pit stop, we saw the number six opted once again for a no-tire strategy. We've seen this a number of times now, and Nick Tandy would say after the race that they think they found something that car is able to work with old tires, and they're able to double stint these tires and still extract a lot of performance out of the car. Whereas the 31, they took, I believe it was right side tires only. The 31 still made it out in front of the six, but the six was able to gain a bit of time back. And really the final, you know, 45 minutes of this race was just between the six and the 31. The six would close the gap up and then, you know, traffic would bring them back apart, and then traffic would bring them back together. And ultimately it was with I think 12 minutes to go in the race, we finally saw what worked out to be the pass for the win. Jack Kaikin just made the wrong decision navigating around lap traffic. He chose the wrong side of these. I think it was a Lexus, or it was a Porsche, I think, and one of the Corvettes. He made the wrong decision in which way to go around them. And Nick Tandy chose the opposite way, and that was the right the right way around. And that was really, really all she wrote. Aitken went off into the sand, gravel, whatever it is, and fell pretty much out of contention for the win, still in second place. But Nick Tandy at that point was able to cruise to victory. On the GT side of things, you know, we saw kind of comers and goers throughout the race. Corvette looked really strong in the opening stint in GTD Pro. We saw Pfaff after some rounds of pit stops. They would assume the lead and lead for a little bit. But really, once Lauren Heinrich got in Rexy, he was on another level with that car, and was able to drive that, make the pass on the Pfaff McLaren and take it to victory lane there. And then in the GTD class, it was an interesting moment at the end of the race. I'm interested to see what your thoughts are on this. There was contact between the 577, I think, is what Turner was running this weekend. They were leading in the GTD class. They had a few second lead on Windward, maybe a couple second lead on Windward at this point. Windward was closing, and Philippe Ellis was closing the gap quickly. The Turn Motorsports BMW got together with the 40 Acura ARX06, who was not really in contention. I think it was Jordan Taylor in the car at that time. Contact was made. The 577 came down, got into the 40, and it was this is in the same corner that actually Jack Aitken went off in and lost the lead in the GTP class. So it was an interesting moment between those two cars. Windward was ultimately able to get around and cruise the final few minutes to victory. But what did you see in this incident? Do you see that Jordan Taylor was in the wrong here, or do you think that, you know, the Turner Motorsports, the 577, you know, that was it kind of just came down on him?
To be honest, I'd like to see an onboard from the 40, which I don't think was available. I don't think they had an onboard on that car that race. I can't remember. Yeah,
I don't think they did.
Okay.
There was an onboard from, I think, one of the GT cars that was behind this that saw it happen. Yeah. I think we had an onboard from that, but I don't think we had one from on board. No, we did have, I think I saw footage from on board the 40, and it didn't, you couldn't really tell that even contact was made.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you sort of alluded to a second ago here, this was, what is this, turn three? Is that what we're going to call it at Long Beach?
I think it's turn three.
That was a corner that was causing a lot of people a lot of trouble in the last 20 minutes of the race. I just thought it was a little bit of a weird incident, but ultimately Windward, the victors, or the ones who made out from it. I want to go back to the same corner, the incident between the 31 and the number 6. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but to me, it's so easy to say in retrospective, I know, but I think if Aitken just held the inside line, that was his best bet there, because it looked like he was trying to pass around the outside. While you could definitely do that in a prototype, the GT car is always going to weave out to the left side of the track anyways on corner exit. So the best case scenario really for him is that he was going to get run off track. Whereas if he tried to take the inside line, I don't think that the 6 car would have tried to make that move around the outside. Again, it's a simple mistake. It's one that I think anybody in the field could have made, and one that Aitken, I think, is definitely going to learn from. Just a gut-wrenching result from the 31 again. And we talk about, what does Ferrari need to do to get a win in the World Endurance Championship, and what does the 31 car need to do to get a win in IMSA this year? It seems like both of them really sold their soul after last season, Ferrari winning Le Mans. And then the 31 car, I can't even remember the last time they've won a race. It was
Sebring. I think it was Sebring that they won, right? That was it last year, I think.
Yeah. So
it's been over a year. We were talking about Wayne Taylor Racing and them needing to get over that hump. I think maybe now it's the 31.
Well, you know, maybe the 31 sold their soul after the championship deciding incident at the end of last season at Petit, but
it's wild. You look at the 31 and they have finished second in three of the four races this year. It, and then the one race that they didn't was Sebring with that accident. So
which is another race they should have won, probably, or at least been in contention for the top two.
Yeah, you look at them so far this year, and we could easily be talking about the 31 having won all four of the races if just a couple of things go their way. You know, they led again almost half the laps in this race. It's they're going to get one at some point, and it's probably going to be a race where they come out of nowhere to pull out a win. That's usually how these things end up writing themselves. But yeah, just gut wrenching for them. You know, you were talking about Jack Aitken and how, you know, he's going to learn from this. Like you said, he's still he's newer to this, to sports car racing. We tend to forget that, I think, sometimes, just how much we have talked about him the last couple of years and how quick he has been. Sure. But still some learning and traffic management to hone in on there. And, you know, he's gonna learn from this, certainly.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I'll give the 31 car is at least they are still consistently finishing P2, and it's not like these small mistakes are really costing them too much in the championship. Although, if we come here at season end and the 31 doesn't win the championship, there are going to be plenty of opportunities in these first four races where we say, if they just didn't do that, or if they just had a little bit more pace here, we'd be talking about a different champion. But I don't know. Hopefully for their sake, we don't end up in a position where we're talking about that in October.
Hopefully not. Hopefully not. And speaking of the championship points, it is the number 7, not the winning number 6, but it is the number 7 that won the Rolex 24, who's at the top of the championship standings. They have a 50-point lead right now over the 31 Cadillac. Things are starting to spread out a little bit there, so we'll have to keep an eye on that as the season continues to wind along. Of course, in the GTD Pro field, with the 62 Ferrari not competing at Laguna Seca, that drops them from the points lead, and it really bunches things up here in the GTD Pro standings. The Rexy, they've had a couple of good results here to start the season. They find themselves at the top of the point standings there, ahead of the 14 Vassar Sullivan Lexus and the number 1 Paul Miller Racing BMW. And then heading on down to the GTD standings. Oh boy, this is looking like a repeat of 2023 all over again. Last year, we saw Paul Miller Racing just, I think they won 5 races over the course of the year. Windward Racing right now has already won 3 of the first 4 races on the calendar. And they have an over 200-point lead over the number 96 Turner Motorsports BMW, they were able to bring it home in second. And then the Wright Motorsports Porsche is third in the standings there after their second podium of the season. Kind of a car that was not initially slated to run the full season IMSA schedule, but I would not be surprised if we're going to see them run the full season schedule with the results that they've been getting. So, you know, it was one of the standout things from this race for me was the lack of safety cars, and in a good way. We really got to see some of the strategy play out, even though we did have a safety car or full course yellow at a time that, you know, just brought everybody into the pits to you know, kind of do driver changes and everything like that. We still got some extended running, which was nice to see. We saw some, you know, elbows out, argy bargy, but there wasn't anything too egregious. I thought overall, I thought Sebring was a pretty solid race.
Sebring.
Oh, sorry. I was looking at the points.
Sebring was a solid race. We'll say that.
Sebring was a solid race, but Laguna Seca, WeatherTech Raceway, Laguna Seca was a solid race.
Yeah. You know, I'll agree with you on that. I think that was a good race overall. It's, as I said at the opener here, I thought that Porsche winning that was a bit of an unexpected winner. Porsche is proving extremely difficult to beat this season. And sure, you might be able to beat them in individual races, but their consistency across both championships right now is just top level. And I would look at them right now as championship favorites. It's very easy to say that when they're leading the championship, but You know, what more can you say about the performance they've put up this year? I think it's a complete 180 from what we saw from them last year. Last year at this time, we were talking about how Porsche is still putting in performances that are a little bit under what we'd probably expect from them, given that huge testing advantage that they had on the other manufacturers going into this new GTP hypercar era. But 2024, they've completely turned it around. And you've already talked about Winward Racing in the GTD category, how strong they've been this season so far. You have to look at them as early championship favorites as well.
Yeah, you really do. It's been impressive what they've been able to do. You mentioned, Porsche looks really strong. Honestly, BMW looks stronger right now than they did at this point last year. I was a little bit disappointed in how they faded over the course of this race. I thought they were going to hang in contention for most of this race. And, you know, they weren't able to stick with the 31 and the Porsches at the front. Well, the Penske Porsches anyways. So it was a little bit disappointing to see them fade, but they are making improvements. So we'll see if that can translate maybe into Detroit or into the 6 hours of the Glen, which of course they will be going into as defending champions. So BMW does have that track coming for them. An interesting one here to sort of wrap up for my thoughts on the race. It was interesting to see Renger fade towards the end of this one. I understand that they also went with a no tire strategy, no tire change on the last pit stop, and they faded to, I think, fifth at the end of the race after starting on pole and dominating the first stint. So that's going to be disappointing for them, but sometimes when you take chances on you take a chance on double stinting tires and it doesn't always work out. So it didn't work out for them here.
Well, yeah, I was going to say the strategy that won them Long Beach, cost them at Laguna Seca. So yep. I want to talk about quickly here Acura in 2024, who's, I think, the number one manufacturer that I would say is, dare I say, disappointing. Of course, they picked up underwhelming, I think, is a better word. They picked up that win at Sebring, which I think the win at Sebring was a little bit unexpected in some way. I think Cadillac was seen as the favorite performance wise at that race, except for that final stint from Delatraz. But I certainly expected them to have more performance here at Laguna Seca. I think the Acura historically seems like a car that's been pretty comfortable and pretty quick in a lot of the high speed turns, which Laguna Seca definitely has no shortage of. It's a high braking zone track, or a hard braking zone track, high speed turn track. And I expected a lot more out of them here. And it really didn't seem like they had the pace to be consistently fighting for the front all weekend. So that's my key takeaway. I have said probably four or five times on this podcast now that, Wayne Taylor Racing seems like they struggle to have consistency to ultimately have a great championship run. I mean, how many years in a row now have they finished second in the championship?
Yeah.
And I think they're going to want to turn that around pretty soon. Of course, you know, you can't blame the drivers of the team 100% of the time. We have BOP, which is going to be brought up. So maybe there's a little bit of leeway that they can get on that front still. But, yeah, overall, I think Acura and Wayne Taylor Racing with Andretti Global, need to turn around their season as we get towards the middle stage of the IMSA WeatherTech season already.
Yeah, they're going to be ones. And you know what? They have the drivers. They have the pace to be able to do it. You consistently look at post-race reports. One that I look at is the B-Pillar report. I would highly recommend, going and checking that out. And Ricky Taylor is consistently up near the top of this list, which ranks drivers on the top 50% of their lap times from when they're in the car. So there's consistent good speed there. They just kind of have to put it all together in a weekend, and they haven't really been able to do that, with the exception of Sebring when they kind of walked into that win. So Yeah. Wayne Taylor Racing, they're gonna come around. They're gonna improve, but just a matter of when.
Yep, I agree with that. Looking at a couple of people in the chat, actually, somebody had actually mentioned Acura had bad race pace again. One step ahead of you. Or actually, maybe you were one step ahead of me since you said it first. I don't think you mentioned this. First IMSA GTD Pro podiums for the 720S and the Z06. Actually, I think one of those was your picks. The Corvette would get their first podium in IMSA. Same pick as the WEC, by the way.
Listen, I was looking at my Laguna picks with like 15 minutes to go in this race, and I've turned my season around. I'm going to get the 31 win. Rexy's going to win, and Turner is leading. Corvette's in a podium spot. Like, I'm 4 for 4 here. And then three of them fall to pieces. Well, no, only two of them fell to pieces, but in pretty dramatic ways.
Yeah. Well, I pointed that out to you. I was like, you're looking pretty strong right now. I can't say that much about my picks. I'm continuing to fall short this season. I will say I was pretty impressed by the pole position for Danny Formel in number 45, Wayne Taylor Racing Lamborghini and GTD. I had just a funny feeling about them. Danny Formel, Kyle Marcelli, I believe they swept the Super Trofeo.
Oh, probably.
Championship, not the championship, but the two races at Laguna Seca last year.
They won like the first 9 races of the season, I think. Yeah.
So I was pretty impressed by that pole position. Felt pretty confident going into the race, but ultimately, they had good pace in the race as well, but it just didn't translate quite as much from qualifying as I might have hoped.
They actually did 2 driver changes in the race as well. Formel started, and then Marcelli came in, and then Formel finished, which is not something that you usually see in the sprint races.
Yep. But like Francisco mentioned here, first podiums for the 720S and the Z06. Corvette's improving, we'll say that much.
They looked good this weekend, on the IMSA side of things, at least.
Yep.
They didn't look terrible at Spa, did they? I can't recall.
Pace-wise, not too bad. In fact, I believe they led one of... No, maybe not. I was going to say I believe they led one of the free practice sessions, but that might be wrong. But ultimately, the 81 car, I believe it was, had an issue in the race that put them in the garage. Incident last year at Indy involved both Penske Porsches and the 31 Cadillac. At the time, Cadillac was leading... by that time, Cadillac was leading after the fact. So it was actually the opposite of what we saw here at Laguna Seca.
Okay.
40 car did have an onboard. I'll have to check that out after the race.
It was interesting because the couple of corners leading up to the actual incident, the BMW, the Turner BMW was kind of, there was a couple of moments where it looks like the door was aggressively shut. And then I don't know if maybe there was some frustration that built in trying to navigate around them that caused Jordan to, I don't even think he sent it in that hard though. He was fully alongside that BMW going into that corner. So
yeah. Let's see. So Laguna Seca and Porsche go very well together. Rennsport's held there too, right? Yes, that is correct. Rennsport reunion is an event that's held, I want to say like every 4 or 5 years, might be a little bit more frequent than that. Really missed the 4 to 6 hour endurance races from the American Le Mans series, but making Laguna Seca a sprint race really makes the races more intense. You know, I guess there's a little bit of discussion there on whether or not we would like to see like maybe a 4 hour endurance race, sort of hybrid endurance sprint race, come back to Laguna Seca, going into the nighttime hours like we used to have. When it was the ALMS championship finale. I wouldn't be opposed to something like that, although I don't think there's really enough room for it as a full 6 hour endurance race with that addition of Indy for this season. Stu, any thoughts from your side on that?
Well, I think I'd love to see it be made, you know, an endurance race. I'm all for more 4 6 hour races. But I think if you make this an endurance race, then you got to make Road America an endurance race again, right?
Hey. MSR will bring the championship back to Acura next year. There you go. There's the number one story with that rumored transition back to, which did we talk about that in last episode? Was that even a storyline that came out?
I think that story came out since our last episode, and that was in that Marshall Pruitt article, right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there was the Marshall Pruitt, there's an article he put on us. It's about Silly Season, I think probably about a week or a week and a half ago now. I think in that he discusses Wayne Taylor Racing, you know, potentially going over to Cadillac and then Meyer Shank Racing. I believe it's both mentioned in the same article, Meyer Shank Racing taking over the Acura program again,
which would be unexpected.
That's certainly that.
Given the way that the Honda / Acura MSR relationship ended in IMSA last year. Finally made it to a live stream. Normally always listening to the podcast. Well, welcome for the first time here live. People are giving praise to the 500 miles of Road America that we used to have as the endurance race in the American Le Mans Series. If you could make one endurance race a sprint race and one sprint race an endurance race, what would they be?
Easily. Easy. Make Indy. Indy's not a 6-hour race anymore. Yeah. And yeah, give me Road America as the endurance race. Unless you want to go crazy.
I would almost say the exact same thing. Yeah. It's like, that's for the sake of being different, I'll say you can do a Laguna Seca 6-hour race if you want.
A 6-hour Long Beach race would be.
No. Don't even say it. But also a couple people saying a joint event at COTA. That would I would take that as well. If you had a joint event with the World Endurance Championship. I don't know if you're going to get two endurance races in the same week, although they did at Sebring, so
it's true.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing something like that either. I want to jump over to a couple of the news stories from this episode, then I'll get back to a couple of questions since there were some from the WEC section that I didn't get to earlier on. The Le Mans driver lineups now are officially complete. The entry list is officially published, which means that we now know 100% sure that Sebastian Vettel will not be racing at the 24 Hours of Le Mans this year in the number 4 Porsche 963. I think that comes as a disappointment, but not really a surprise to a lot of people. I'll say give him the chance to test a little bit more. I think it's actually been brought up in recent days. I don't know if this is really anything with too much backing to it, but the potential for him to run an entire season in the World Endurance Championship next year. Maybe some of the more senior drivers like Andre Lotter or Fred McAvecky in the World Endurance Championship hang up the helmet or move over to a reserve driver role. And Vettel would be able to step into a seat like that. I know Vettel's name has been tossed around in the F1 world recently with the Mercedes switch up and everything going on over there. So let's take it back to step one here, though. Let's talk about who will be racing in the number 4 Porsche at Le Mans this year, which will be Felipe Nasr, Nick Tandy, and Matthew Jaminet. Same lineup in that car as the number 75 Porsche from last year's 24 Hours of Le Mans. Not a whole lot more to say about that one. I think, again, there's plenty of time for Vettel to step into that car, whether it's a one-off at Le Mans next year or whether he tries to run the entire World Endurance Championship. That's a race that I think just matters a little bit too much to Porsche this season. Their run in 2024 has been extremely strong. That's a lot of pressure to put. I'm not going to discredit Sebastian Vettel's quality or capability at all, but for him to jump into Le Mans as his first race with a factory team that's going for their 19th Le Mans win, I think that's a lot of pressure that Porsche might not want to pile on him right away. Also hearing that Felipe Drugovich will be racing for Action Express in the number 311 Cadillac. That will be his debut in that car. Has been testing that car. I think he actually tested it at Laguna Seca a couple of weeks ago for Action Express. Perhaps maybe we see him do some IMSA outings over in the future as well for that team. But I believe he's still an Aston Martin reserve driver for Formula One as well. So a notable name.
We could still see him in some IMSA events then, you know, Aston Martin joining the IMSA grid in GTP next year.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Depending on that two.
Knock on wood.
And then the last notable here that I want to talk about, because this was a surprise to me, is that of Jordan Taylor returning to the GT Racing ranks in the, not a Corvette, number 155 Spirit of Race Ferrari, alongside the father-son duo of Johnny and Conrad Larson. Yeah, this is, to my knowledge, first pro, I'll say, like, first real big race in a Ferrari in the GT ranks. He'll be returning to the GT ranks after racing the factory Corvette for a number of years there now. Just returned to prototype racing, though, stateside this year. But I guess he decided he wasn't going to step away from GT for all that long, and we'll be going back there for Le Mans. Any thoughts from you on any of those driver lineups that I mentioned, though?
Just goes to show Jordan Taylor wants to race at Le Mans, and if Acura doesn't want to go to Le Mans, then, you know, maybe it adds some more fuel to the rumor.
Yeah, yep. Also got news, though, that'll let you take this one. JDC, though, is targeting a second GTP Porsche for 2025.
Yeah, we could potentially see, what is it, a bushel of bananas? Is that what, I think that's what the term would be. So we could see another banana boat, whatever you want to call it, on the grid next year. Well, it might not be yellow, but essentially here, JDC and Miller Motorsports, they've been discussing this for a while, that, you know, they've been interested in adding a second car. A second entry to the grid, pardon me. They did actually take delivery of a second chassis over the winter, which is to be, they're using that for, you know, as a backup for spare parts, etc. But they are seriously looking into getting a second full season entry for next year. Of course, this is dependent on there being a car available for them. It's also dependent on things like sponsorship, of course. Can't go racing if you don't have sponsorship dollars to do it. So there's a lot of things that would have to fall into place for this, but it is something that they're seriously looking into. And also worth noting in this is, and something that I haven't really seen any coverage on, is that JDC Miller is going to be adding an LMP2 entry for a couple of races this year. At CTMP, where the LMP2 class is a headliner. Of course, that makes some sense, considering that the GTPs aren't going to be there. So it's not like they need a second crew for this car, for that event. But they're also adding an LMP2 entry for Road America. So they're running a couple of races in the LMP2 class. Who knows? Maybe this could be something that we see more from them, whether it be as the season goes on, as sort of a precursor to an additional entry on the grid next year. But hopefully we'll see them on the grid. They did mention that they are open to it just being a Michelin Endurance Cup only entry next year as well. So, you know, there's lots of options for them, but this is definitely going to be a story to keep an eye on. And, you know, we do only have these two privateer entries on the IMSA grid right now. It really doesn't look like we're going to get many other privateers from other manufacturers. There was a BMW article as well that I read on Sportscar 365, where they kind of shot down that idea, unless if it was, you know, a really good fit. So, you know, it seems pretty unlikely that we're going to see many privateer entries outside of Porsche. So seeing an additional JDC Miller car on the grid next year in the GTP class would be great.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. And, you know, if you need an additional 963, I know they have two now because they got that second one over the winter, but if you just need a backup car, I think there's a WEC team that may or may not be trying to sell two of them over the off season.
Well, they probably have just a couple of extra though, spare ones kicking around too. So, yeah, you know, a third. Yeah,
just a rumor. Yeah, you know, the more entries we see, especially privateer entries that we see in IMSA, I think the better. Unfortunately, they're not getting quite the number of manufacturers that we have in the World Endurance Championship right now. Like, we don't have Ferrari there, we don't have Toyota there, we don't have Well, I guess Lamborghini is planning on running full time in IMSA next season. Again, we'll wait and see on that, depending on the potential of that two car requirement for the WEC. But I'm never going to shoot down the opportunity to have an additional hypercar on the grid.
Should have Aston Martin on the grid next year too.
I get, yeah, hopefully. I don't want to,
hopefully,
you know, count my chickens before they hatch. Want to go back to a couple of questions here. Actually, I got corrected. It would be Porsche's 20th win at Le Mans. And I should have known that. I was thinking in my head, I couldn't remember if they had 18 or 19 currently, since they haven't won overall since 2017. One of the things that was mentioned earlier, I'm going to jump back to the WEC here. Alpine was looking competitive, but the Peugeot was nowhere to be found. And I think that's another one of those talking points that came out of Spa, is just the lack of pace that we're seeing out of that new 9X8. They their best performance of the season on absolute pace was Qatar, which is the race that they were running the 2022 spec car. So, you know, time will tell with that car. I think there was actually a thinly veiled BOP article that came out today or yesterday, where they were discussing that they think they have a little bit more pace in that car. Just need a little bit of a break from the big bad BOP to show some of it, but we'll see what that car can show at Le Mans. Last year, Le Mans was their standout race, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see some more performance out of them there as well this year. But yeah, for the first couple of races with that new car, not quite the debut they'd probably want to see out of that Evo spec car. Alpine was in the mix for a podium place as part of the red flag. They were there on the Toyota AF Corsa and some of the Porsches. Yeah, exactly like I said. I think my prediction actually for this WEC weekend is that both cars would finish in the top 10. Didn't quite have that. The 36 car finished 12th, but overall, still a big improvement from what we saw at the first couple of races in this season. And then there was one more that I wanted to jump back to. So with this coming year being the second 24 hours of Le Mans that the LMDH cars will race, what are their greatest strengths and weaknesses versus the Le Mans hypercars? And which brand do you think has the best shot at a win? I don't know if they have any specific strengths, to be honest with you, over, you know, one way or the other. I think the good thing with the championship this year is they're doing a pretty good job of blending those two formulas together to the point where it's not really noticed. A lot of people were putting the tinfoil hats on, saying the ACO will never let an LMDH car beat their precious Le Mans hypercars. Never will happen. That was quickly shut down at Qatar this year. It was backed up at the last race in Spa. So I don't know if there's a specific strength that the LMDH cars in general will have over the hypercars or vice versa. The second part of your question, I think, is a lot easier, which is I'm going to take it the LMDH manufacturer, I think, has the best shot at a win, which would be Porsche. You have to look at how serious they are this year with the factory Penske program, and then also Jota picking up that win at Spa, and then also Proton being as strong as they were at Spa. And then the fact that they have basically two times as many cars as every other manufacturer on the grid has. They have five cars racing at Le Mans. No, I'm sorry. They have six cars racing at Le Mans with that third factory car, instead of two cars from the likes of Toyota, three cars from Ferrari, three cars from Cadillac. I can go down the list, but they got strength in numbers, and they also have strength in pure performance this season as well.
I think, you know what, I'll go against you. I'll go with Cadillac for that Le Mans LMDH. The red Cadillac's got to win something, right?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, maybe that would be there's two teams really that deserve some good luck to go their way this year, and it's Ferrari and it's Action Express. So maybe that's the duel that we see at Le Mans this year for the race win. Either one of those, if either one of them win, I think that would be enough to turn around the season of misfortune they've had so far.
Yeah.
Do you think they would extend the race time at the 24 hours of Le Mans if a red flag happens? Will this rule only be applied at shorter races? I don't think it would apply. Well, there's nothing in the rulebook stopping them from doing it at Le Mans, to my knowledge, unless the race time that is set is only allowing them to go up to 4 p.m. local time, which is when the race ends anyways. If that's the case, then no, I won't know that until we actually get to the race itself in a month's time or so. But also, in the 100-year history of Le Mans, there has never been a red flag. I'm kind of hoping that that doesn't change this year, because I definitely don't want the controversy that we had at Spa to come around at Le Mans. There are so many times this season where I've said, at least this didn't happen at the Rolex 24, or at least this didn't happen at Le Mans. So the can of worms that the whole thing opens from this weekend is that the race directors have a choice. Race control can make the choice to extend the race. They're not obligated to extend the race. It is at their discretion to say, we want to add time onto the clock. To my knowledge, they can decide exactly how much time they want to add onto the clock as well. So at some point in the future, I kind of hope we don't run into a situation where it's the same scenario, but then they don't extend the race, because that's going to bring up plenty of questions as well as to, well, you did it here, you didn't do it in this case, what's the deal? But again, hopefully it's a good number of seasons before we actually have to answer that question anyways. Let's see. Do Bourdais and Van der Zande stay at Cadillac, or do they stick with whoever Chip Ganassi Racing goes with? That's a great question that I have wondered myself, and one that I cannot provide you a sufficient answer with. I would guess that they probably go wherever Ganassi goes, if Ganassi stays in sports car racing. So in the hypothetical situation, well, actually, the other part of that Marshall Pruitt article is that Ganassi will not be taking over Acura. So
yeah,
I don't see both of them leaving sports car racing with Ganassi. If Ganassi just pulls the plug altogether, maybe they get scooped up by another team. Perhaps they're not racing on the same team anymore. But I would say their allegiance lies more to Chip Ganassi Racing right now than Cadillac specifically.
Yeah.
But that's just my uneducated take on it.
There's a good, I mean, if you're listening to this, clearly you're a pretty big sports car racing fan, so you've probably heard of Dinner with Racers. There's an episode or a couple of episodes they did with Sebastian Bourdais, and they kind of talk to him about that, and whether, you know, like, talk about the situation with Chip. And I believe he mentions in that episode that they're contracted to Chip Ganassi. And it definitely sounds like, especially Bourdais would want to stay in that Chip Ganassi Racing family. But then, like you said, if Chip Ganassi Racing isn't going to continue in sports car racing, then, you know, they're probably going to, both of them still have many years left, many competitive years left in them. So I imagine that they would do whatever they could to stay on the grid in one way or another.
Yeah. And with the potential of more customer cars popping up on the grid in both championships, you know, maybe there's a seat for them open there as well. Wouldn't put it past either of them to try to scoop up one of those seats if the opportunity arose. So I'll tell you what, we're around the half hour mark, a little bit over, not the half hour, hour and a half mark of this episode. I'm going to wrap this episode up for tonight. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. At least that's the plan right now, provided that there is not a reason for me to get stuck. This worked better in my head at the Indy 500. So we'll be back for a preview of the IMSA race at Detroit, which will be an hour and 40 minute race. And then we have also not an IMSA race or WEC race at the first weekend of June. But one of my favorite sports car races of the year that I think everybody should definitely check out, at least for part of the race, is the Nürburgring 24. I would say in the top five races in the world, in any category, I would put the Nürburgring 24. So going to probably talk about that a little bit, might squeeze a couple details in there with some of the IMSA WEC drivers taking part in that event. But until then, we got a couple weeks off. Hope to see you all at the end of the month. And then we're going into the month of June. I guess not the entire month of June, but we'll have a couple of weeks to preview the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Thank you all so much for tuning into tonight's episode. Hope to catch you in the next one. Take care.